From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're lucky to have Andy Card. Andy was a top advisor to Presidents Reagan, President George H.W. Bush, and was chief of staff to President George W. Bush for 5.5 years. On Transition Lab today, we're going to talk to Andy about the transition into power for Vice President George H.W. Bush when he became president in 1988. So Andy, thanks for being here and thanks for joining.
My pleasure. I'm really honored to be with you in the Transition Lab.
So tell us how you're doing during this time of pandemic and how you're doing with social distancing.
I'm practicing the social discipline that we're required to practice. I'm in a vulnerable age group because I'm an old man.
No.
So my wife and I have been married for almost 53 years, and our children and grandchildren are very attentive to make sure we don't do anything to catch the coronavirus. So we're practicing social distancing here in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. My wife is a Methodist minister. She came out of retirement and is running a small church in Peterborough, New Hampshire.
Well, I want to thank you for one other thing, which is you being such a nice person. I just want to remind you, you'll forget this, but when I was at USTR, I was 26. You were running the Auto Association, had been Secretary of Transportation, and I was assigned to work on auto issues, and I got to work with you, and you were incredibly nice, gracious, and patient with me, even though I was a 26-year-old kid who knew nothing. So thank you very much for being nice to me as well.
David, it was an honor to work with you, and I remember you very fondly as being very, very intelligent, hardworking, and dependable. I'm grateful for the dedication that you showed when you were working at the U.S. Trade Representative's office.
Thank you very much. So let's start with the transition. The 1988 transition was unusual because George H.W. Bush was the first vice president to be elected president since Martin Van Buren in 1836. So when did President Bush, or then Vice President Bush, actually start to think about transition planning?
Well, because he had served in so many different positions under so many different presidents, including Vice President to Ronald Reagan, he had a pretty good understanding of how government worked. So I don't think that his expectation on transition was to learn how government worked and then decide how to do it. It was, I've been doing it for a long time, and I want to show everyone how well I can do it. I think that he spoke to Chase Untermyer very early on in 1988, which was the election year, and said, this is what I want to do. I want to be ready. And so, Chase, would you please plan what a transition should look like? So he kind of assigned Chase the responsibility to put together a plan for a transition. So that would have been January, February of 1988. And Chase kind of did it all by himself. He didn't call a lot of attention. He's never been one to look for the limelight, but he did a lot of quiet work and wrote papers and stimulated discussions. And there weren't many people that even knew he was doing it until it was kind of the summer after the primary process had almost come to an end and we were getting ready to get to the Republican National Convention. And I think it was David Broder wrote a story and kind of outed Chase Untermyer for planning for a transition.
So how did that leak out? Because Bush basically instructed Chase to keep it confidential. So who leaked it?
Well, I seriously doubt that it came from Chase Untermyer. I think that it was leaked. I think it was actually leaked by candidate George H.W. Bush, who had great respect for David Broder and maybe had somehow got the word to David Broder that I've got somebody working on a transition now and it's Chase Untermyer.
Right.
I also think that it might have been done to calm people down before the Republican convention if they were all going to start looking for jobs. And it kind of outed Chase Untermyer as the person that was going to help people find jobs in the administration if they were successful.
So Chase's work was run outside of the White House. It was supported by the RNC. Why wasn't it part of the vice president's office? And why didn't this happen in the government?
First of all, Chase was given this task without a lot of consultation. I don't think the Vice President Bush talked to many people about doing it. Chase had probably stimulated some interest. I think he sent a memo to Vice President Bush saying, you got to think about how to transition in. So, and President Bush's relationship with Chase was so close that I'm sure he just made this on his own and kind of tasked Chase with doing it. I think it was smart how they funded it and did it. And Chase worked under the Republican National Committee's budget. First of all, he didn't spend a lot of money doing it anyway, but he was smart to do it under the Republican National Committee budget because there was no provision for the federal government tax money to be used on a transition. And right now, the laws have been changed, and they do allow federal money to be spent preparing candidates for president to be ready to be president. But at that time, they did not. And it wouldn't have made sense to use money that was donated to the campaign to elect George Bush president to use the money to fund a transition. So I think it was prudent and the right person. He also kept his mouth shut. You know, Chase is not one who stands on the mountaintop yelling and screaming for attention.
So Bush was vice president. He was a candidate for president. How much time did he actually spend on transition, and how often did the transition team brief him or meet with him?
Well, in the early days of the campaign, he did not spend much time with it. He left Chase to his work, and Chase wrote memos, and those memos would be reviewed, and they would really anticipated, I think, what was a problem that a lot of people hadn't thought about. This was a transition that we would call friendly. It was a friendly takeover. It wasn't a hostile takeover. Most of American history has had transitions that were centered around hostile takeovers. My candidate lost, your candidate won, and it's a different party. This was a friendly takeover, and so we had the added burden of managing the expectations of people who were working for President Reagan, who just assumed if George Bush got elected president that they'd just stay in their job. So Chase anticipated that and actually started working on that with some of his memos early on, so we paid a little bit more attention. But candidly, the campaign was so focused on the campaign, they were not spending a lot of time thinking about the transition. It was kind of left to Chase.
So one of then-President-elect Bush's first decisions was who to pick as his chief of staff. And there was a big battle then between his longtime aide, Craig Fuller, and John Sununu, who was the governor of New Hampshire, who basically helped Bush get elected, since New Hampshire was such a key state. So how did that play out, and what do you remember about that decision?
I remember this process very, very well. President Bush and I had a candid relationship that went back years. He would occasionally talk to me and ask what I thought about different people, Craig Fuller being one of them, and John Sununu and others. And I was not surprised that most of the Washington community was kind of in the Craig Fuller is going to be the chief of staff camp. I'm not sure that John Sununu's name came up an awful lot, even in the political community, but I knew that President Bush was very grateful to the work that Governor Sununu had done in New Hampshire to help him overcome defeats in the Iowa caucuses and the Michigan experience, and New Hampshire put Vice President Bush's campaign back on track to success and created a climate that allowed him to win. So I was not surprised when John Sununu's name was mentioned frequently, but I'm going to guess it was after the election, so it was probably around November 10th, 11th, or 12th, where I had a kind of a sense that Vice President Bush was giving very serious thought to having John Sununu be his chief of staff.
And so you were going to be deputy chief of staff, which you knew, so you were essentially involved in picking your boss. So that's a pretty good job.
That's kind of an overstatement. I'm blessed to have known John Sununu in politics. I was a member of the planning board in the town of Holbrook, Massachusetts. I got elected to that position in 1971. And John Sununu was on the planning board in the city of Salem, New Hampshire. So I had known John Sununu from planning board days in New England. And we both ran for office at similar times. So we'd see each other as we did radio talk shows and traveled around New England. So I was a big John Sununu fan and still am. He's one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. Sometimes he's not that smart, but he is really, really intelligent.
So one of the things that President George W. Bush really laid the groundwork for was he set the gold standard for transition planning out. Josh Bolton, your deputy, became chief of staff, and Josh really is the master of transition planning. So what was the Reagan administration like in terms of the transition process to the Bush administration, the Bush 41 administration?
Ken Duberstein was the chief of staff at the time, and I think he was a caretaker chief of staff and was attentive to the responsibility of getting ready for a transition, but there wasn't the institutional expectation that the sitting government would do much to help with the transition. It just wasn't the mindset that we came to recognize, I think, first by George H.W. Bush, when he had the hostile takeover of Bill Clinton coming in. He wanted to do that right, so he put together a very cooperative role. I was privileged to be in charge of that. And then once George W. Bush became president, the transition was different, and it had to be kind of institutionalized because we'd been at war for so long.
Right.
And we also had the economic crisis of 2008. So I think that's what really changed things. So 2006 to 2008, Josh Bolton was chief of staff, and he did an outstanding job of not only helping the president do his job, but helping the president help the next president to do his job.
So one of the things that Josh did was he worked with both the Obama teams and the McCain teams. Do you recall if the Reagan team also worked with the Dukakis team while they were also collaborating with the George H.W. Bush campaign and the George H.W. Bush team?
I think collaboration may be too strong of a term. I know Penn James and Chase spent quite a bit of time talking to each other, and I know there was some helpful kind of lists of this is what cabinet agencies are doing, or these are people within cabinet agencies and these are their jobs. But I don't remember. Ken Duberstein did help by, this was much later on in the transition, by sending letters to all of the appointees saying a new president is coming in. We want to make sure the new president has the right to put people in positions that he wants to put in. So think about sending in your letter of resignation. The letter, I don't think, generated any response.
I guess he had to send that twice. I guess people saw their mail, except they ignored that piece of mail.
Yeah, and this was the challenge of having a friendly takeover, where people who are working for President Reagan presumed that they would, of course, just stay on the job and continue to do what they were doing. But Ken Duberstein really understood the real responsibility of a president, and that's to put people around them that they want to put in there, build a team. And Ken tried to help. And eventually it did make a difference, but it did take some time to catch on. But that was much later in the process than what Josh Bolton did, helping with the transition from George W. Bush to Barack Obama.
So how did the Bush 41 team decide which Reagan appointees could stay and which should go?
Chase's job was to understand the lay of the land. And then when the transition was formalized, then it was collecting names and assessing abilities and trying to make people fit. But I do want to call attention to a reality that has been missed in a lot of the books I've read about in transitions. We tend to think of the transition as one transition. It's really two transitions that a president makes. One is the White House staff itself, and the other one is the transition of the executive branch of government. And I feel strongly that President George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush both recognized that the transition at the White House has to be done, I think, under the tutelage of a chief of staff, because the chief of staff is responsible for running that staff. The cabinet agencies is a very different requirement. So the transition, even under from Ronald Reagan to George H.W. Bush, there was a kind of a separate transition for the White House staff vis-a-vis the rest of the executive branch. And where the responsibility overlaps is in the Office of Presidential Personnel. And Chase was brought in to run the Office of Presidential Personnel right after the transition had been completed. So that was building the departments and agencies, Schedule Cs, the cabinet secretaries, the deputy secretaries, assistant secretaries, and the commissions and the ambassadorships. And the White House staff transition is really run more by the chief of staff. So there are really two transitions. And just to put things in context, I had the privilege of working under every chief of staff scenario that served Ronald Reagan and eventually George H.W. Bush before I became chief of staff. But every time there was a change in chief of staff, especially under the Reagan administration, I would tender my resignation. I started off as a special assistant to the president for intergovernmental affairs, very heady title and a great responsibility. And when chiefs of staff would change, I would tender my resignation and expecting that the new chief of staff should decide who the staff should be. I don't know why, but fortunately, I was told, we want you to stay here.
Do you ever think it was a close call that maybe they might accept it?
So I do feel that the chief of staff should have more or disproportionate say in who the White House staffers are, since the chief of staff is held accountable for how the staff is doing its job.
Yeah, I would say that history would show that the two Bush administrations and the Obama administration did a good job of that, focusing on the White House staff first and letting the chief of staff pick the staff, whereas the Clinton administration and the Carter administration really focused on the cabinet more and not the White House staff, and that probably hurt both of their presidencies, at least in the first year.
Oh, I think it did. Well, for example, Mac McClarty, who's a dear friend.
He's a wonderful guy.
Was the first chief of staff to President Clinton, but he was about the last person named.
Right.
So the White House staff was all built before he became the chief of staff. And the cabinet was built without his input. And I don't think that was the best model. I think George H.W. Bush had a very good model. Ronald Reagan had a good model. And remember, he kind of surprised people when he picked Jim Baker to be his chief of staff. James A. Baker III had been very, very involved in Vice President Bush's campaign against Ronald Reagan. And so when Jim Baker became chief of staff, that sent a big signal as well, which was very positive.
Well, one of the books that I read preparing for this interview had a quote from you which said, hostile takeovers in a transition are easier. Why did you say that, and why was the Reagan to Bush transition so difficult?
Well, again, the friendly takeover has the expectation from people who are working on, quote, the same team, that they're going to continue to work on the same team. And a hostile takeover, everybody understands, there's a new sheriff in town. There's kind of a credible expectations that things are going to change, including people. And but even then, I ran the transition out when there was a hostile takeover, when Bill Clinton came in and George H.W. Bush was leaving office. I was in charge of that transition. And I remember President Bush asking me to call the Clinton people and say, the president will do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. If you want him to clear the decks and so that you can just put people in, we'll do that. Or we'll leave people in there and you can clear the decks. Which would you like? And they said, oh, that's very nice of you to do that. It'd be wonderful if you'd clear the decks, with the exception of a few people. And we said, well, tell us the names of the people you want to not have resign, and we'll suggest that they should stay on. Obviously, the vast majority of people, according to the Clinton incoming team, would be expected to resign. I was given the task to call those people and say, President Bush will accept your resignation effective the day that he leaves office. And it was surprising how many people, including cabinet members, said, no, I'll just wait until they remove me. And so I'm not planning to leave. And President Bush said, no, I promised I would clear the decks. We'll clear the decks. So it was much easier to do that in the context of a hostile takeover than a friendly one, where the conversations were very different. You know, I always supported the vice president when he was Ronald Reagan's vice president. I've been doing a good job. I'd like to stay on the job. So I think I'll stay.
So who was the hardest person to actually get out of their office in your recollection?
Okay. Under George H.W. Bush, it would have been Jack Kemp.
He just did not want to leave.
He said, I'm going to stay here as Secretary of HUD, and I'll let the Clinton people, I won't leave until my successor is confirmed.
And you said to him,
I said, the president would like to accept your letter of resignation effective at noontime on January 20th. And he said, well, I'm going to stay on until I get my successor is confirmed. That's just one of several, but that was very notable. And in fact, he basically told me that he was ignoring me, that I didn't really have the authority. And I said I was calling at the president's request. And he says, I don't believe that. And but anyway, it was a very awkward thing for me to do.
So one of the other challenges of the Reagan to Bush transition was how Bush put his own stamp on the presidency. Reagan was an incredibly popular president, a strong president. He revolutionized the Republican Party. But Bush had to show that he was different. So how did you do that? And what were the key things that President Bush did early on to say this will be a different tone, a different presidency, a different approach?
Well, it started with George H.W. Bush, who recognized that he didn't have the same personality as Ronald Reagan. He wasn't the same kind of communicator as Ronald Reagan. And the world was also different. And George H.W. Bush has got the greatest resume of anyone who's ever been president. But it's a resume grounded in relationships developed through his years at the UN or as envoy to China or CIA director or chairman of the Republican Party, or vice president, whereas Ronald Reagan's was kind of built by celebrity status and great communications and the ability to translate political jargon into a common everyday language. And so I think George H.W. Bush recognized he wasn't Ronald Reagan. He agreed with Ronald Reagan on most of the policy aspects, but he wasn't Ronald Reagan, so he was going to have a different style to his government, and he was adjusting to his style. I think that it ended up proving to be George H.W. Bush was the most successful one-term president in the history of our country. And he had unbelievable success stories during his four-year presidency, starting with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And we went from a Cold War to transition to a unified Germany without a war. And the relationship with Russia and the Soviet Union changed dramatically. And so from a foreign policy point of view, unbelievable successes. He did not have Congress, was not of his party. The Democrats controlled the Senate and the House. And he was still able to get the Americans with Disabilities Act passed. He was able to get the Clean Air Act passed. He had tremendous successes, and we tend to forget that. But it was a difference in style, not so much a difference in policy.
So I want to move to the George W. Bush presidency, but I want to ask you one question, which is, President Bush lost the election. It was a tough election. The country wanted change. Since then, the country and basically history has shown a much more favorable light on George H.W. Bush. What do you think his biggest legacy will be?
His biggest legacy, I think, is that he was a decent man and truly respected by people who didn't agree with him and worked very, very hard at not practicing braggadocio. It was never about him. He was a very, very humble leader.
Let's move to the George W. Bush administration. You were chief of staff for 6 years. Nobody else has lasted 6 years.
Well, I was blessed to have phenomenal people around me, starting with Joshua Bolten, who was deputy chief of staff for policy, and Joe Hagan, who was deputy chief of staff for operations. And then successors to Josh Bolten were remarkable people like Harriet Myers and Karl Rove. I had really good people who helped me as deputy chief of staff and on the entire White House staff. The second thing is rock stars in the administration like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and Dick Cheney. Vice President Cheney could not have been a better partner. He had been a chief of staff under Gerald Ford. His office was right next to mine, and he never blindsided me. He always kept me in the loop. So in terms of the work environment, there was a great team, and I loved working with them. The second thing is that they were all more competent than I was, and I knew that. So I trusted them and tried to empower them and tried to help the president. The chief of staff is supposed to be the skeptic, the honest broker, the one that does think about consequences so that there are fewer unintended consequences, and then have the courage to say, I think you maybe should talk to somebody else in addition to the people you've already talked to before you make your decision. But ultimately, you're also responsible for lifting everyone up so that they will be proud to implement the president's decision.
Andy, we had Josh Bolton on the Transition Lab, and one of the things that he talked about was how you and Josh went to President George W. Bush in the fourth year of his presidency and said, you really should plan your fifth year and your second term now. Don't wait until after the election. And Bush didn't take your advice. So now we're in the fourth year of a Trump administration. They could win. What would you advise the Trump people to be doing now to think about a potential second term?
Well, I think it's very important that you not start your planning for a second term until after you've won the right to have the second term. If you wait that long to start your planning, you'll probably be about 6 months late before you can implement it. So I would think, you know, what kind of foundation should be built this year that will help next year and the year after that? So both Josh and I had the view that, you know, good planning does make sense and you want to lay the foundation.
And the second term often is much more difficult than the first term because basically all the issues have been postponed. You typically have a more hostile, less flexible, less supportive Congress. Second terms could be much, much more difficult. Is that your experience?
Well, second terms, by definition, are lame duck terms. So the day the president gets reelected is the day that somebody else thinks about being president. And that gets exacerbated over time.
So my last question for you is about the crisis we're currently experiencing. We're taping this in late March. We're in the middle of a shutdown nationwide because of the coronavirus. It's the biggest crisis in my lifetime. I'm 53 years old. The second biggest crisis in my lifetime happened on 9/11. And I remember perhaps one of the most poignant pictures of the Bush presidency is when he's reading to a bunch of kids and you came in and whispered in his ear, the country's under attack. So having lived through that crisis, what advice would you have for the Trump administration of how to manage and how to improve their management of this crisis?
A steady hand is critically important. On September 11, 2001, I want to put things in context. When the president arrived at the Emma E. Booker School in Sarasota, Florida, there had been a buzz in the air, and I remember two people raising it, Carl Rove and Dan Bartlett, both asked a question. Anybody hear about a plane crash in New York? And the president, when we arrived at the school, went to a secure phone and called Condoleezza Rice's national security advisor. I did not hear that conversation. But as we were getting ready for the president to go into a classroom with second graders, I had already gone into the classroom and checked it out and saw the second graders lined up. They were all excited to be going into this classroom. I saw the press pool starting to gather with Ari Fleischer. And I came into the holding room with the president. I'm standing at the door beside the principal of the school. And White House advisor, who was the acting national security advisor on the trip, came up to the president and said, sir, it appears a small twin-engine prop plane crashed into one of the towers at the World Trade Center in New York City. The president, the principal, and I all had the same reaction. Oh, what a horrible accident. The pilot must have had a heart attack or something. And then the principal opened the door to the classroom and she and the president walked into the classroom. The door shut and I'm left inside the holding room. And Captain Lauer, Navy captain, who was the acting national security advisor on the trip, the director of the White House Situation Room, came up to me and said, sir, it appears that was not a small twin-engine prop plane. It was a commercial jetliner. My mind flashed to the fear that the passengers on the plane must have had. They had to know it wasn't gaining altitude. I don't know why that's where my mind went, but that's where it went. But that was only a nanosecond because Captain Lauer came up to me and said, oh, my God, another plane hit the other tower at the World Trade Center. My mind then flashed to three initials, UBL, Osama bin Laden. I knew who he was. I knew about the attacks on the World Trade Center in early 93, late 92. And I knew about the Al-Qaeda network. And that thought didn't last very long, because I then said, I've got to tell the president. And one of the toughest jobs chief of staff have is to, you know, does the president need to know? This was an easy test to pass. Yes, he needs to know. What do I tell him? I made a conscious decision to pass on two facts, make one editorial comment, and to do nothing to invite a conversation, because I assumed that he was sitting under a boom microphone. Mm-hmm. I knew that he was sitting in front of second graders and a press pool, and I didn't want to have a dialogue with him about it. I also reflected on another time that your listeners may remember. I was the acting chief of staff when George H.W. Bush went to Tokyo, Japan, and threw up on the Japanese prime minister. And everybody thought the president was dying. And I was the acting chief of staff, and I had to go with him in the ambulance, which he refused to get into, then move into his limousine. He threw up all over me. We drove to Akasaka Palace.
That's ultimate service.
And then I took out my little laminated card and said, I've got to make sure the world doesn't think he's dying. And so I did everything on my what do you do in case of plan. And I said, I'm going to do everything the same way I did on that day with regard to President Bush in this classroom. I'm going to be cool, calm, and collected all day and try to be a steady force for the president. I opened the door to the classroom, and long story short, I whispered into his ear, a second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack. He did not turn around and talk to me, which I was pleased. I then stepped back from him. I could tell he was thinking and thinking. And then I went back to the door, looked at him again. He was still, his head was kind of bobbing up and down. The students were so attentive to their books. They had, were taking out their books to read with the president. The press pool was all turned around talking to Ari Fleischer. And I saw the principal of the school and the Secretary of Education, Rod Page, mouthing what's up. And I walked into the holding room, and the first thing I said was, get the FBI director on the phone, get a line open to the vice president, get a line open to the White House Situation Room, get the crew back on Air Force One, Secret Service, get ready to turn the motorcade around. We're going to have to leave. Dan Bartlett, get some remarks written for the president. He's going to have to say something. We have 600 people in a gymnasium. He's going to say something, but we can't say anything we do not know to be the truth. So that was 9/11. I tell you that the goal should be today that the president doesn't say anything he doesn't know to be the truth, that he doesn't practice hyperbole, and he doesn't overly state the nature of the problem, but yes, lift people up to so that they understand that we can solve these problems, we can work together, we can make it through. So what I recommend today is that take this coronavirus COVID-19 seriously, practice social distancing, keep those people from who are most vulnerable from being infected with the disease, and pull together, rally as a country, and follow the president's lead. He's our president. Whether you like him or not, he's our president, and we want him to succeed and help us get through this. That's what I would tell people.
Andy Card, you're a great American. You're also an incredibly nice person. I was the beneficiary of your kindness. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for your service to our country.
David, it was a joy to be with you, and thank you for your leadership, and thank you for doing a great service for the country, because presidents will always be transitioning.
Thank you, sir. If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.